Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Author Amitabh Kumar's new novel, A Time Outside This Time, is set at a writer's retreat and reflects on the issues of fake news, memory, and the ways in which truth gives over to fiction. Kumar has crafted his fiction so seamlessly from real life that the reader is forced to reckon with what is real. A Time Outside This Time captures a feverish political moment with intelligence, beauty, and an eye for the uncanny, a meditation on life in a post-truth era. Amitabh Kumar is a writer and journalist and the author of the novel Immigrant Montana, as well as several other books of fiction and nonfiction. He is a professor of English at Vassar College. Again, the title of the new novel is A Time Outside This Time, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Amitabh Kumar back to The Book Show.
Thank you so much.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this novel, but one of the things that really struck me is that you were writing so much in the now, in the moment, and yet there are things that I think of myself as I'm reading that going, my God, did that really happen? And did that just happen? And it seems as though you're dealing with that as well in this.
Yes, because you know what, Joe, one horror is very often succeeded by another horror, and the news comes galloping at us and we forget things. And I was trying to remember, what was the name of the man killed on Thursday? Because I only remembered the name of the man killed on Saturday. Or what was the lie that was uttered by someone in the White House on Tuesday? Because it has already overtaken my memory of what the man in the White House has said the previous week. So how to set it down in ways that both becomes memory work, the task of remembering things, and at the same time making sense of things, trying to frame what has happened in some context of understanding or insight.
When it came to you were going to write a novel, and I assume you also ended up at a writer's retreat.
I did.
Did you know what you wanted to tackle, or did that just come to you because it was what you were ruminating on?
I knew what I was going to tackle because it was such an overwhelming reality after 2016. I had been keeping a journal. I read in an interview that President Obama said that his daughter had read Hemingway,
Right. Write
the truest sentence you know. And I thought, you know what, I'll write the most revealing lie I have learned that day. And that journal I had been keeping for a couple of years. So when I arrived at that residency 2 years later, I knew that I was going to make sense of what was happening and try to make sense of it.
You write early on in the book, what is the opposite of rumor? A scientific fact, of course. But once you start thinking of rumors as stories, which they are, it becomes clear that accounts offered by scientists about their experiments are also stories.
Yes.
Well, here we are.
You know, I wanted folks to understand that the response to rumors, of course, has to be rational thinking and factuality, but we should also be skeptical of facts. What are the interests? I mean, didn't science in this country for the longest time believe that black people are inferior? And wasn't there a science called phrenology that tried to explain through measuring the size of the skull what the innate capacities of people were? So how to maintain an enormous skepticism? And for me, fiction, practiced in good faith, I decided was perhaps the best response either to ideological rumors or to ideological science.
So there are two main places where the book takes place. One, of course, is at the retreat and
Yes. Talking
to the people who are in various pursuits,
yes, not just
writing, but
that's
in
exactly right.
Various pursuits. And you're talking to them and kind of dealing with what either they're working on or the news of the day. And then you go back and there's the recollection of India and either your the character's
background
and childhood and upbringing and even more contemporary moments.
Yes. My narrator is a journalist and also happens to be a professor of English at a college in upstate. My GPS says that maybe it would be a little bit more north of Vassar. I don't know. you know, so he is making sense of his past, but then the pandemic comes and that floods in, and that is a departure that makes it necessary for him to return home to the U.S. He's aware that the WHO has said that with the arrival of the pandemic, what people are also faced with is an unprecedented infodemic. So he wants to sort the truth out from that other fiction called fake news. And so there is a chapter that is just news, you know, one after the other. It's called The Velocity of News.
The main character's wife is basically a data scientist.
Yes. And she represents good science.
Yes.
But he doesn't entirely. He loves her a lot, but he doesn't entirely. He's eager to present her findings or her, you know, how she explains human behavior, which is scientific and not, you know, led easily by prejudices. But he also doesn't entirely have faith in it because his truths, it seems, are more individual and a little bit more complicated than the plain storytelling of science. Science says X happens, and then when Y happens on X, Z is the result. And he is not entirely sure of such things.
He does seem fascinated by it. Several
yes.
times in the novel, he says, well, I have to report back and see what she makes of
yes.
this.
Yes, but wouldn't you be, or wouldn't I be? I am fascinated by it. For example, he reports what his wife says to him about the Stanley Milgram experiment.
Yes.
Carried out in New Haven. It was a response to Adolf Eichmann's declaration that he was only following orders. So Milgram, a psychologist at Yale, decides to find out to what extent will we carry out orders, even when they seem to be inflicting pain on others, just because a figure in authority tells you. So this guy, my narrator, is interested in what his wife reports about research on behavior. He's sometimes not sure if that's how it happens, or he wants to get to the bottom of it, or he wants to see how does it work out in his real life. And so, for example, is a story where he goes to talk about an informant in India, and he discovers that, you know, the state is a writer of bad fiction, you know, worse than some of us who actually write bad fiction.
The idea of the experiment is if you shock someone,
yeah.
and then what you will do if there are people who are in pain and around you, and how that works in the various. I was thinking there is a famous scene in the movie Ghostbusters where that is illustrated.
Okay, listeners, please take note. Check out YouTube.
your book is obviously much more scientific in this fact than Ghostbusters, but it does exist. So let me ask, though, it tells us a lot about us, though, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. If a figure in a white coat says, or if a figure in authority, like in the White House, or in case of my own country of birth, if the Prime Minister says it is okay to gather in thousands or hundreds of thousands and take a dip in the Holy River, you will be protected from COVID, or cow dung will protect you from COVID, then people believe it. That is dangerous fiction. So how, instead of believing in, surrendering to the figure in authority, how to be enormously skeptical, how to be questioning is something that my narrator is struggling with.
You are writing this, as you said, in real time. So do you need time to ruminate, or is that guttural, visceral reaction helpful in the writing?
I had this ambition of writing that appeared fresh like blood on the bandage, you know, so that you see there's something vivid about it, there's something immediate about it, but you also sense a deep wound. So there was that thing. But then what I was trying to do, and why it isn't entirely visceral, is that my narrator says that he's also interested in slow jamming the news, how to slow it down, because the news is coming to us with such a fast momentum and overwhelming us, how to slow it down. So at one point, he actually begins to paint from a newspaper picture of a man being lynched in India. He begins to paint it just to slow it down, what he sees there, what he's seeing. And I wanted to actually ask a question for my readers. What does it mean to slow down the news for us? And what would it mean to absorb it slowly? And what are the practices that now have become necessary? Because every instant, the world is coming to us very fast. How to save what is not only human, but thoughtful about us?
And by slowing it down often in the illustration that you have just presented to us, the answer is often horrific.
Yeah. It would be a counter to a benumbing of the senses. Mm. And maybe it will be too much, but it's better than too little.
Because we should feel something.
Yes. I mean, how to keep alive violence done to another is also a violence unto ourselves. And if we cut it off, it will, through repression and burial, return with greater force and destroy us. So how to retain a sense of memory and acknowledgement and to keep a sense of responsiveness alive? I think that's the most deeply humane, human, and ethical thing. And that's what I was trying to do in the book, trying to understand how I should be.
Did you always know where you were going because you were also following what was happening?
Yeah, no, I did not know exactly where I was going. Because where do you stop? I was taking a little bit of cue, I must say, Joe, from also Orwell's 1984, and thinking, what happens to the man who is there? Wilson Smith, if I remember the name right?
Yes.
And what happens to him? And should I present this as destruction? And then the election happened, you know, so I was waiting also for the news of the election to think, am I here to say, look, we did not believe in science, we gave in to everything, or was it, should I just temper it? So I was in some ways in dialogue with what was happening and finding a way through that. So my book ends, I think the last clipping that appears in the book is a tweet from Trump saying, I won this election by a lot.
Right, right. Which is right after Election Day.
Yeah.
And you reference 1984, but you talk about that in the book. The narrator is reading that as he's working on the novel, which is Enemies of the people.
Yes.
So two questions. One is, were you reading 1984 at that time too?
Not for the entire course, but yes, I was. And I thought by placing it across all chapters as a reading exercise, there could be more of a coherence. It would become another narrative thread. But yes, I was reading it. And after a very long time, I was reading it. So it was for me an act of discovery and trying to think, is it really relevant or not?
Well, it seems relevant.
It does very much. And I could understand why the sales of 1984 went up so much after Trump's election. I was trying to figure that out too.
And basically, you bring us to many moments of examples of this is what it says in 1984 and this is what happened yesterday.
Yes, yes.
Oh, by the way, they're really similar.
Yes, yes, yes. That was because I was struck by that. I was struck by all those similarities. You know, the idea that one language could replace another, that we would willingly believe what was false, that we would succumb to the oppression of a state language, propaganda. And the so-called myth that we have, that we are all free.
The chapter 6 in the book, The Velocity of Lies, you say, quote, here are collected fragments on the construction of facts and fiction. They are excerpted from the journal entries in my notebooks. Those readers more interested in the story than in the news should skip this chapter and go directly to the next one. I implore you not to skip it. It is fascinating. But there are, what, 33?
Three, I believe.
33. And were those indeed journal entries?
Yes, they were. They were. I have 9 or 10 small black books that I filled with these quote-unquote revealing lies every day. And so, in other words, I also wanted to say to the reader that this novel, how was it made? So the journal entries were indeed there. And I had maybe 50 of them, and my editor said if he could cut it down. Thankfully, he thought it was a good idea to have those entries about the news interrupting the story. Because I don't know about you, Joe, but when the pandemic came, I was just doom scrolling the news, you know, and I was thinking how to both reflect that and also to slow it down and to have some startling juxtapositions.
You present facts sometimes just a line or two such as number 17. Mm-hmm. In March 2019, I came across this mention of Facebook and mental health. Quote, according to a Verge report, Facebook's content moderators get paid $28,000 a year and often end up with PTSD from looking at awful stuff all day. That's something you can think about for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And otherwise, as you say, if we didn't slow jam it, it would probably just wash over us.
Yeah. You know, these things that happen in the news could sometimes be a whole bloody novel, you know? But just to present it as that, or to talk about where Facebook, if there was a power outage, then the kind of attacks on refugees didn't happen, and where Facebook was, how many attacks did take place in Germany, you know, this is from a report in the New York Times, this is a number 16, is, I think, quite striking. And I just wanted to have it there by itself. Not a part of a story, just have it by itself. And you read it and you absorb it. It's a, like a lesson about... Joe, there is one that I would like to read out, if you don't mind.
Please.
It's a very short paragraph. It's number 13. And I wrote this because I wanted to think about how everything becomes normalized. Everything becomes acceptable till everything has changed. Why must one slow jam the news? Because all that is new will become normal with astonishing speed. You will go to visit your father and discover that he has pledged himself to the service of the great leader. Or you will visit your friend's house, and it will take a minute or more to realize that a meeting is underway and now everyone is looking at you with suspicion. You notice one fine day that all the signs on the road have changed. Your town has a new name. Dogs have grown fat on flesh torn from corpses lining the street where you grew up. The beautiful tree outside your window is dead, has been dead for some time, and has, in fact, just now burst into flames.
Amitava Kumar reading from A Time Outside This Time, his new novel published by Knopf. Wow, you think so much and you have so many questions in this novel and you put them down and every one of them, as you say, it could be, yes, a novel, but it could also just be an entire couple hours of thinking. At one point, I think you say, I lay awake at night and you're thinking of these things. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is you talk about the novel coronavirus and yes, also give us a definition of that and the definition of what you do for a living is a novel.
Yes, yes. The novel comes from Latin word meaning new. And that is also the idea, you know, the idea of news, the idea of novel, and the idea of the novel coronavirus, the novel in that term, all of them are related to both new and what is happening in the world, therefore. How to make sense of what is happening in the world. And I was trying to understand, or in that particular section, I was trying to foreground the question of what does fiction, what should fiction do in a world where you're surrounded by the fiction that is bad news, that is fake news? And my answer is, I guess, that you need to exercise enormous skepticism. You need to know about the role of the state, and you need to put your stories next to other stories that question it. And I suppose not listen to Fox News.
You also touch in the end about what, you, as I mentioned, of course, you teach at Vassar, and of looking through the students' lens as well, of how they're figuring all this out.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, you know, the pandemic was raging, and then the Black Lives Matter movement, and whether it is on questions of climate change or gun control or racism, it is the youth who are doing, in my opinion, marvelous things. And I, because I teach and therefore I learn from my students, I wanted to pay homage to that. And I wanted to recognize that the future just depends on them. And I think if we are going to be saved, they are the ones who are going to save us. We haven't done a great job, but the youth, we have to invest our hopes in them.
I'm teaching this semester too, and it seems to me that they have a cynicism and a skepticism that seems healthy.
Yes. They also have sometimes a sense of judgment that I find a little bit unnerving, you know, because...
They blame us.
Yes, yes, yes. And sometimes, just yesterday I was talking with a colleague of mine who said that our students are a little bit impatient now with judgment. I mean, they do not want to be cancelled. And that makes me a little fearful, but I also have enormous faith in them because they are, have their eyes turned towards the future, unlike us who are sometimes bogged in the past or only in the present.
In the novel, you don't seem to, you lay the seeds, but you don't seem to want to go to, okay, where is this going to bring us? What is that future going to look like?
I do not. I do not.
You harness that.
Yeah. I would like to do another project that thinks in those terms. This is very much a response just to the present, to think, where are we? And how to let not the present be so quickly consigned to forgetfulness of the past, but something that is interrogated. That is what the book was trying to do. Like, how did we come here? And I see, especially in India, how what is happening, you know, whatever your listeners are familiar with under Trump, how much worse it is there. And I think I have made this controversial claim that because the sun rises earlier in India, we are ahead in India. And what happens there, every barbarity that is meted out to minorities and everything, every falsehood that is inflicted from the state on peoples will then become the fate of America too.
The connection between Trump and Modi.
Yes.
And looking at that.
Yes.
And the novel is important because we see it not only as an American phenomenon, but as something that is all over the world.
Yes. The coronavirus taught us that we live in a globalized world. Viruses don't respect borders. It is the same with populism and prejudice. None of this is only one nation's inheritance. We are dealing with a shared problem.
One of the things that I love about the novel is that it has such beauty. It could be a much angrier book.
Yes.
It isn't angry.
Thank you. Thank you. Jonathan Franzen somewhere says that if a writer cannot be comical, then he doesn't trust such a writer. You have to be a friend to the reader. And I think life isn't only rage and anger and despair. You know, we were laughing just a few minutes ago.
Right.
We have laughed while we were talking. And I think that's, if a writer is to be faithful to life, there should be an observations about joy and love. So I have a chapter called The Nature of Love.
You write, obviously, about love, and I'm hoping you can read a section about that.
Yes, let me read Essential Services. Every day that week, a line formed outside the liquor store by noon. Those in line stood 6 feet apart, checking their phones or reading a book or looking up at the trees. 12 people were allowed at a time into the liquor store. A man and a woman, wearing masks and gloves, arrived from different directions. The man, who might have been in his 20s and whose mask was blue-colored, made a flourish with a gloved hand and let the woman take the place ahead of him. For a moment, he studied the back of the woman's head. She had blonde streaks in her hair. "You weren't answering the phone last night," the young woman said to him, turning. "Do you think it's easy for me to step out like this?" Her companion hadn't stopped smiling under his mask ever since she arrived. He now said, "I've heard that the wait is longer in the line outside the CVS on South Hill Road. Your father must need his medicine. Let's meet there tomorrow."
Amitava Kumar reading from his new novel, A Time Outside This Time. I so often ask authors about how they feel when they complete a novel and when there's sort of the decompression and the leaving of the characters and of the topic and then it slowly is being removed from you. And yet for you, because you're writing about what you're writing about, you don't leave it.
Yeah.
It's still there.
It is. It is. In the same way as the virus is still there. So then I began thinking of the second wave that happened in India and the enormous devastation, lives, you know, people not being able to get oxygen. So I have been working on a novel about the second wave and misinformation, and I'm just trying to write another story out of that. And I don't think that will go away. In fact, I want to think a little bit more and persist with what are the new ways of understanding violence and falsehood that afflict us.
The idea that the virus is something that we can understand scientifically, but also in the hands of certain people can be violent and can be used for violence and can be used as a weapon is hard to even get your head around.
Yes, but we must address it. I mean, Zadie Smith has a great phrase called, I think it was something like, contempt is a virus. So that's the difficulty. How to understand the virus, not only in terms of, you know, that little shape that you see, the spiky thing in right. all the pictures about the coronavirus, but also what is inside our thinking, in our beliefs about others and about ourselves and our desire for faith in some demagogue. I think all of that is a virus too.
Talk about how you end the novel, because it's basically with you writing.
I'm a little bit skeptical of that, but I also must confess I have great faith in the act of writing. Because that's what I teach my students, that when you write, you're putting down words on the page in order to find a way out of this desert. Bring some order into chaos. So the novel ends with writing because he's trying to put down something that is like a testimony also. And that is about, the first line of the testimony is, a lot of life is left in a man being killed. Maybe we can think, for example, a man is dying, he's almost dead, he's being killed. What does he think? What are his thoughts? Think, for example, of George Floyd. But in my case, I was thinking of a Muslim man who was killed in India because he was suspected of eating beef. And that was the start of the novel. That's how it started, really. And then my editor said, actually, that's where we should put that at the end as a way of explaining something of where the road started. And so I thought that was a good idea. So that's where it ends. But yes, it is about writing, about the faith in the act of writing, of finding language. Language being the landscape toward in which we explore understanding.
And through your writing, it can help us understand and explore our feelings as well.
Well, that's my humble expectation, yes.
it's realized.
Thank you. You're so kind.
The name of the new novel is A Time Outside This Time by Amitava Kumar. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.